This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On today's show, the history of racial categories in America and the effect they're still having today. But first, the number of high-profile sexual harassment cases in the news lately is prompting a national conversation about a pervasive problem. And whether it's a high-profile case or one that doesn't make the headlines, every workplace is affected. Here to discuss the reporting process and what companies and HR departments can do to properly handle harassment complaints are Graydon Law Firm attorney Julie Pugh, Director of Client Relations for Strategic HR Kathleen Snyder, and attorney and University of Cincinnati Carl H. Linder College of Business Assistant Professor Peter Burrell. You can join us 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Peter, Kathleen, and Julie, thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And let's start with the definition. Julie, what is considered to be sexual harassment in the workplace?
Sexual harassment in the workplace is typically defined through federal and state laws. The sexual harassment statute springs from Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and is encapsulated in that definition of sex as was written in Title VII. Various states also have their own definition of sexual harassment, and it's been expanded upon through case law throughout history. So it is a factually dependent definition that is rooted in our statutes in the both federal and the state governments.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would be some examples, some common examples of sexual harassment in the workplace?
So there's really two types of sexual harassment. There's quid pro quo, which is a this for that. It's if you engage in the sexual activity with me as your supervisor or manager, then I will give you some benefit or avoid some detriment in the workplace. The second type, which is really what we're here to talk about this afternoon, is the severe and pervasive. So it is a hostile work environment definition that where behaviors of severe and pervasive behaviors have created a detriment in the workplace. So it's where an employee is experiencing a situation that is affecting their ability to do work.
And the conduct that we typically see boils down to unwelcome, inappropriate touching, inappropriate comments. It can rise to the level of sexual assault or rape. That would be severe, or pervasive, which would be those kinds of comments happening over a fairly long period of time that creates what the courts have determined is a hostile work environment.
Kathleen, how pervasive is this? How common is this in the workplace? Do we have an idea?
It's not new. This has been happening. I've been working in this space for almost 20 years, since the early 2000s or so. And it's been happening. We're certainly hearing about it more and more. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad thing that we're hearing about it, but it's not a new topic. Hopefully we can address it promptly and, just nip it in the bud before — we were chatting about that a little earlier — before it becomes a bigger problem. It's just a matter of how vigilant companies need to be with it.
Mm-hmm. And I would sort of take – here's my approach. I think I'm a little bit older than these folks. Been doing this since 1984. My first sexual harassment suit was in 1986, and it was a quid pro quo case, a supervisor requesting sexual favors from someone that they supervised in exchange for job benefits or the threat of termination. What I've seen, and this is just me anecdotally, I made a lot of money off sexual harassment cases in the 80s and 90s. In 1998, the Supreme Court basically said to employers in two seminal cases, Farragher and Elderth, said to employers, look, we don't really want to police this. You guys police it. Create an anti-harassment policy and then enforce it. And what I'm going to tell you and tell the audience is what we're seeing, what we've been seeing in the last several months and really in the last year, I think it's an aberration, to be honest with you, because here's my experience. And from 1986 till about the year 2000, 2 years after the Supreme Court made those decisions, I had probably a dozen cases a year involving sexual harassment, both on the plaintiff side and the defense side. Since 2000, maybe two cases a year. The last case I had that was a sexual harassment case, I defended a company. The case didn't even get filed. We got a letter from a a woman who had been terminated, asserting that the owner of the company had sexually harassed her. We set the case for mediation and got it settled in a month. So I think what you're seeing now is areas, well, they're companies that have a culture, and we talked about this before, a culture that, you know, is not good. And, you know, Fox News, Uber, these are, I would call them bro cultures. And they basically have a situation, you know, you have companies that are not the typical company that are not following these rules and not self-policing.
I think there's a certain extent of that, and I agree with you in a lot of ways, Peter. What I see, I'm more on the HR side of things, and what I see more of, I've seen a little bit more than what you have, but on the HR side of things, what I see is a company trying to address it before anybody's calling an attorney, before anybody's calling the right. EOC or something like that. So companies trying to be more proactive right. In addressing those types of situations.
Right.
Now, our assistant producer, Selinger Reeder, has been getting comments from people about their experiences with sexual harassment. And I'd like to get your thoughts about each of these. We've got several different audio cuts to play. And let's play this first one here.
Hi, my name is Rachel, and I have an active federal lawsuit whom I am suing a higher education institution. I had so much fear in telling the ombudsman about my harassment that I actually pleaded to her not to tell HR. I feared retaliation, my safety. My predator held much power in his position. So when I did contact the police of the incident, the investigation started. I then was shamed. I did endure retaliation on campus. My predator harassed me via text messages, even during the investigation. I was not able to go to many areas on campuses, such as student services, due to fear of retaliation. People that used to be nice to me and go out of their way to say hi now gave me dirty looks and would walk right past me. I think what bothers me the most is that the head of HR has a personal relationship with the accused, so she decided to refer the matter to another HR manager. So even though she did that, she still made the decisions in regards to ongoing retaliation complaints in regards to my Title IX case. But since then, I've had ongoing panic attacks and anxiety. Even when I went to disability services in regards to getting an extension on an assignment, the counselor actually told me that PTSD, which I was diagnosed with due to the situation, was not a disability, even when I explained my situation extensively.
So what I get from Rachel's story is that it can be very difficult personally to pursue a sexual harassment claim like she has. And I wonder what your thoughts are on her particular story.
Well, I don't want to comment on an ongoing piece of litigation, but I will comment on how she felt before she brought the complaint forward. And that is whether it's a manager or an HR person, whoever's the recipient of that complaint initially needs to be able to receive it without making a snap judgment. And so it's being able to listen to the individual's concerns and not have an emotional reaction to those concerns. So we've talked a little bit about Harvey Weinstein, and then you've got Matt Lauer. And if you ask somebody about those two, oftentimes they say, oh, well, Harvey Weinstein, well, we expected those to come out because we knew who he was. That's an emotional reaction. Oh, of course he did. But then you have the Matt Lauer contrast, which was, oh, my goodness, I can't believe he would do that. And that's an emotional reaction. And so whether it's Rachel's comments or an individual who's looking to come forward about concerns within the workplace, the recipient of those concerns, manager, HR professional, C-suite executive, needs to be able to say, thank you for bringing those forward. Tell me more. Tell me about your experience, rather than having that snap judgment. And I think what we hear in that clip is that emotional reaction because she feared that whomever she talked to would automatically jump to conclusions.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, Julie, that's very well put. And I think from an HR perspective, my role initially is information gathering and find out as much as I can. We go back to the basics, the who, what, when, where, how. Did anybody else witnessed this? Are you aware of anybody else that has experienced this? And just pure information gathering before I start to make judgments. And then as I look at it, honestly, as I'm putting together a picture or I'm putting together a puzzle, and I'm trying to get as many pieces as I can before I make any determinations of what's really happening here. Because you'd be surprised how often different points of view may either round things out or lead you in a different direction or what have you. So I think that's one of the most important things from an HR perspective is just information gathering first.
I would agree with that. And I think it's also important to be cognizant of the fact that every HR department is different, right? And every company is different. I represent many companies that don't have an HR department. They just have managers or owners. And so it really, I think it does depend on the company's culture. You know, HR departments, they're one of the first lines of defense, obviously, because that's where most anti-harassment policies direct women or men who think they've been harassed to go report. So.
And we will continue our conversation about sexual harassment. 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. We're talking about sexual harassment in the workplace with Graydon Law Firm attorney Julie Pugh, Director of Client Relations for Strategic HR Kathleen Snyder, and attorney and University of Cincinnati Carl H. Linder College of Business Assistant Professor Peter Burrell. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we've got some more comments that Selena Reeder gathered, so I'd like to get to the next one.
Jarrett Jackson, Bond Hill. As far as seeing sexual harassment in the workplace before, I'm an RN by trade. So, of course, hospitals that I've been in, you always get it to a certain extent. I mean, whether it's playful, unintended, intended, I think it's just the culture that's been represented to a certain extent. And even to a certain extent, almost accepted. But of course, I think by some of these new cases that have come out now, I'm pretty sure that tide will change. Nurses, from what I've seen, do not have a recourse as far as if they are sexually harassed by patients. Usually something pass along and report as far as, oh yeah, that patient, he's kind of weird or something like that, or that patient's going to hit on you or something like that. Nurses are harassed by doctors, yes. Yes, they are. Especially depends on the type of hospital, whether it be something that is a large hospital, who the harasser is, if they're, you know, a powerful doc or something like that, a powerful surgeon, something of that nature, they've been there for a very long time. So I think it just depends on the area that it's in.
Okay, thoughts on that? He's talking about the medical profession, but sexual harassment occurs in a lot of different professions.
I'm going to jump in because I saw everybody's eyebrows raise at the statement in nurses don't have a recourse. That would, first of all, surprise me that in any hospital, in really any major hospital in any city in the United States, not only will they be trained, not only will they be aware that there's an anti-harassment policy, their managers will be aware of it. And again, you know, not every hospital is the same and cultures are different depending on the hospital, but nurses would have a recourse if a patient was sexually harassing them. That violates Title VII, if it's severe or pervasive. But I think probably the more interesting issue was doctors harassing nurses. Again, nurses would have an avenue to report that through the company. They're the first line of defense. And then it gets back to culture.
Well, and he brings up a very good point that, and I've seen this on a number of different occasions, the person who is conducting the behavior that is problematic is not a direct employee of the organization. And it certainly presents challenges, but it can't be overlooked. The organization still has a responsibility to protect its employees from unwelcome and unwanted harassing behavior. So even though it's a customer or a patient or a vendor or someone of that nature, a contractor, the organization still has a responsibility there and a liability there. Does it get a little trickier? Sure, it does. You have to, you know, you got to go about it a little differently. You have a little less control over the situation than you do if it's a direct employee. But that doesn't mean that you just swallow it or you just say, well, it is what it is. You still need to take some action on it.
And I want to pick up on one of the words that Kathleen said that I think is really important as it relates to this comment, and that is unwelcome. And we have workplace cultures that are stricter about the types of behaviors that are allowable within the workplace, and we have some that are looser when it comes to the language that employees use with one another. The line from a harassment standpoint that is drawn is whether or not the conduct is welcomed or unwelcomed. And whether and who makes that judgment? Anybody who receives that comment. So it's not necessarily just the person that it's directed at. But if there is a bystander or a witness that sees sexually based conversations going on and it doesn't appreciate that or finds that to be unwelcome, it's on that person to also report that behavior in order to bring that workplace culture in line with how the company is allowing or is allowable for those behaviors. So the line is not whether or not you call somebody honey. It's whether or not the person who receives that honey.
It's very much about perception.
Right. And welcome or unwelcome.
Welcome or unwelcomed.
When I'm working with people, harassment, it can be a very personal thing because what I might think is harassment, Mark, you may not think is harassment. What I might think is harassment, Peter may be going, you have got to be kidding me. But it's that perception piece of it. And it is whether is it unwelcome or not. And that threshold may be different for each individual person. But as an organization, there is no hard and fast line. You've got to walk through and explore it based upon that person's perception.
I want to add one thing, and I think this relates to what's going on in the news today, and that was the listener's comment about doctors being disciplined or not being disciplined because they are powerful or not powerful. Again, anecdotally, I've represented doctors who have been disciplined by hospitals, in fact, terminated, not for sexually harassing behavior, but for basically really bad comments that happened over and over again, counseled, didn't stop, they're gone. I mean, that goes back to the organization, what their tolerance is and what their expectations are of their employees.
Let's get another one of the comments and then we got from people that Selena interviewed. So go ahead, Josh.
My name is Rebecca Fanning, and I'm from Cleves, Ohio. When I first started, I would wear skirts and dresses, which was business professional. Everyone else was. It wasn't an issue. But since I was a young 22-year-old, I would wear skirts, again, to my knee. My boss pulled me aside and told me I wasn't allowed to wear that anymore because of the men in the company. They had been seen looking at me or checking me out. And therefore, instead of having the men change how they view women and being inappropriate, I had to go out and buy a whole new wardrobe of pants and things like that because I was creating a distraction.
Thoughts on that?
Wow.
Yeah.
She's right. She's right. And part of that is the culture of the organization. Part of it is I understand sometimes there's coaching for someone young in their career and I've had those conversations, what's professional or what's not professional, but from the circumstances as she's describing them, there should have been some coaching and there should have been some counseling and things back to the individuals or just the organization as a whole. And again, just setting a tone and culture of a respectful professional environment.
And I think, you know, really that is part of the price that women pay in the workplace. I mean, there are challenges, and again, I'm not a woman, obviously, but I've represented many women who have had situations in the workplace that have been very, very difficult. And you know, I think men need to be more sensitive about what kinds of hurdles women have to jump over in order to be in the workplace. And I mean, let's be real here. We're still in a white male dominated culture. Women have a harder time making partner in prominent law firms. Women have a harder time making tenure at universities. So again, does discrimination, is it still out there? No question about it. No question about it. But I believe, you know, Title VII was passed over 50 years ago in 1964. It was passed to deal with a very problematic issue in our society, which is discrimination, which is judging someone by how they look or who they are, not what they can do. And our society made a decision, you know, and this is part, I mean, not, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is the crown jewel of the civil rights movement. Has it changed America in some very significant ways? Absolutely no question about it. And the evidence is there. Do we still have a lot of work to do? No question.
With this particular situation, there are a number of ways to solve that problem. And the fact that the company and the individual took the route that they did is something that we can discuss. Are there better ways to address that kind of a situation? Yes. Is there training that we can provide to allow individuals who are engaged in those behaviors that are causing some uncomfortable workplace conversations to occur to change their behaviors? Yes. The fact that that was the method to solve that problem is where I think we need to have more discussion within that company and with those people to come up with a better solution.
Well, and some of that too comes down to this culture that we're talking about, and a culture of respect and a culture of professionalism. And I believe she said that this was her supervisor that someone higher up, that this was their response that she needed to change, not those that were had the questionable behavior. The culture piece of it comes from the top down, and it starts at the very top and every level in between. But the leadership of the organization has to set that tone, and from what that appears in that particular comment, there's something missing there.
Let's get in another comment.
Jennifer Marco, I'm from Pleasant Ridge. I personally have not encountered anything in regards to sexual harassment in my workplace. I've been in IT for about the past 6 years. I feel like every place I've worked, they are pretty aggressive with HR and the policies and procedures and standards that we do follow. But like I said, I personally haven't experienced, but I'm sure others have.
Okay, there's somebody who's having a good experience at work who has
good.
Yeah,
good
yeah.
For
where
her.
Where the culture right. is good and the HR is doing its job.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, again, I'm going to let you
no, give that's,
this one. Cause.
I think it, I mean, so good. So HR sounds like where she has been working, HR is doing a good job. And we kind of, in the HR world, I guess we have a little bit of a position that HR can be the guardian of the culture. But me as HR, I can't take it on 100%. It's got to be everybody has to buy in. And I firmly believe in when I'm working with organizations, when I'm doing training with organizations about these type of issues in these types of areas, every single individual in that organization has to take ownership for the culture and has to take ownership for how do I treat other people? What am I doing that might be problematic for somebody else? And when you have people who are willing to do that, you can create a fantastic culture in an organization. And you get into areas where now more than ever, I think it's important that we do that. Yes, because we have this hot topic, because we have so much going on in the news in this particular topic. But on a bigger picture from an HR perspective and from an organizational perspective, quite frankly, the thing that's going in my mind right now is on a couple of these situations where if it's a bad situation, go someplace else. Because there's a lot of openings, there's a lot of opportunity for jobs and not that many good people to take them. And so that's something that the company has to be aware of is if I'm not going to take this seriously, if I'm not going to treat my people with respect and make sure everyone is treating people with respect, I'm going to lose some talented people.
Yeah. I think that's an excellent point. And think about if you are the managers at Uber, How difficult is it for you right now to attract top IT talent? Not just women, men. There are a lot. I don't take Ubers anymore. I literally don't. I read the article. I was appalled.
Especially in the current job market, it's in the job right. market right now. It is hard to find good people. Unemployment's low.
Right.
You know, there are certainly more jobs than there are good talented people. So especially now. Other times when the economy's not doing so well, when unemployment is higher, companies maybe feel a little differently, that they don't have to be as vigilant. Not saying that that's true. Not saying that that's a valid position to take. They just get a little bit more of a comfort level because they figure, oh, there's lots of people who aren't working. I can go find somebody else.
Well, and I teach at UC 18 to 22-year-old, and then in the MBA program, 25 to 30-year-olds. They're, you know, they look, they research these companies. They're not stupid. And if they've got a company that they have heard is not a place that is respectful to women, men, they're not going. So
let's run the next comment that we have here.
My name is Adar, A-D-A-R Johnson, and I live here in Cincinnati, Ohio. To be honest, I have seen a lot of sexual harassment in the workplace. Some flirtatious, some touching, some groping. And to be honest, it haven't been complained about, you know, it's stop nor don't. Some people do stop, you know. But as far as me seeing someone personally get in trouble on my work site for sexual harassment, no. My feeling about HR, if they're serious about everything can be written down. If everything written down, everything can go back. But if HR is not writing things down, writing the complaints and can go back, then they're not doing their job and they're not serious.
Everything in writing, your policy in writing, your complaints
absolutely.
In writing. I mean, that's a good point.
Absolutely. And it starts with the policy, and it has to be a well-constructed policy. So you better believe that I'm working with various different employment attorneys to make sure I've got a well-constructed policy. It needs to give some examples of what is the types of things that constitute harassment. It needs to have some complaint procedure of specifically how can we go about. And I'm not sure. I mean, I'm HR. I've got two attorneys sitting with me, too, but I think they're nodding. But, I mean, it's got to be a well-constructed policy that you're addressing specific issues, that you've got an alternate person. You can't just funnel everything through one person for a complaint, because what happens if that person is the problem? There's got to be some specific aspects to that policy that it's going to have a leg to stand on. And then you've actually got to live that policy, and you've got to take these complaints seriously. And yeah, she's right. There should be some documentation. I mean, we kind of have a mantra in HR. If it's not written down, it didn't happen. So she's on to something there.
So what can we do better? What can HR do better, do you think, Kathleen?
I boil it down. We keep coming back to, and I'm a little ad nauseum here, quite frankly, but it really is. It's the culture. It's taking ownership of the culture. It's creating an environment that is respectful. It's creating an environment where we revalue our people and they know their value. They feel listened to. There's opportunities to grow and to learn. And when you create that kind of groundwork, and addressing the one-off situations, even before we were talking outside earlier, that it's a pretty high threshold to actually be legally considered harassment. It's a pretty strong threshold to be severe and pervasive, as Julie was talking. I advocate, don't let it get that far. Nip it in the bud before it becomes a problem. When your people are making inappropriate comments, when people are, creating a little bit of an uncomfortable environment, maybe it's not harassment, but it's, okay, I don't really like hearing these comments. Get it early, do something about it now, and then hopefully you nip that in the bud before it ever rises to the level where it's severe and pervasive.
I couldn't agree with that more, and I think what we're seeing more and more of is companies not only having an anti-harassment policy, but a first line of defense, a code of conduct. And that, because Kathleen is absolutely right, asserting a claim of sexual harassment and proving it, two very different things. It is very, very difficult to establish, to get beyond that threshold of this is sexual harassment. The courts have set pretty high bars to that. So when people say, oh, that's sexual harassment, well, one inappropriate comment does not rise to the level of a hostile work environment as it's defined by the law. It's got to be severe or pervasive. And that means severe is sexual assault. Pervasive means it's happening, inappropriate comments, inappropriate touching over a longer period of time.
So it's a hostile environment you sometimes hear people mention.
Yes, yeah, okay. Exactly. But again, what Kathleen says is absolutely right. Companies, they don't want to get it. They don't want it to get that far. They want to nip it in the bud early on where where it is an uncomfortable behavior.
Here's the thing. You can have the best policy in the world written down, have every single legal check mark documented, but if you're not acting upon it, and the behaviors of the people in the workplace aren't being examined, addressed, and individuals held accountable for following that policy and creating that supportive, non-sexually charged workplace, it doesn't do you any good. The paper's not, it's not worth the paper it's written on. So even if we do have everything written down, even if the policies are there, if we don't have individuals, and when I said bystanders or witnesses earlier, managers, people who are involved in those conversations, you know, whether it's the lunchroom or the water cooler or, you know, on a work trip, if we don't have individuals who are following those policies and holding each other accountable to behave in an appropriate and professional way, then we're not doing what we need to do to establish the positive workplace culture that people want to work in.
I tend to advocate ownership of your behavior. And I've been a lot involved over this 20 years. I've been a lot involved in a lot of different investigations. And I can probably count, I've been involved in probably well over 100. I can probably count on one hand the times that the individual who was accused of harassment was deliberately, maliciously trying to make somebody's life miserable. More often than not, oh, I didn't mean anything by it. Oh, we were just kidding. We were just joking. Or, yeah, that's Joe. Joe's a jerk. He just is. We just know we have to deal with him. But the people don't realize how what they're doing is affecting others. And so it really starts with a little bit of a self-examination. Is something I'm doing making somebody else uncomfortable at work?
When it comes
and
down
if
to
each
what you're saying,
person
Kevin,
does that,
your corporate culture is so
if
important
each person does that, That's a good starting point. And also, if you're taking care of the day-to-day, when there is a one-off incident, it's a lot easier you can recover from it, that people are a little bit more forgiving or that people, you know, Joe, you crossed the line on that one. We need to have a conversation. And you can still recover from it.
Well, Kathleen and Julie Peter, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Graydon Law Firm attorney Julie Pugh, Director of Client Relations for Strategic HR Kathleen Snyder, and attorney and University of Cincinnati Carl H. Lindner College of Business Assistant Professor Peter Burrell. Coming up, the history of racial categories in America and the impact they have today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.